Were you ever involved in any controversial plays?
Yeah. I don't think I was. I could have been too when we were playing Montreal for the one of the last games of the Little World Series. Chris, what was his name? The big pitcher that pitched for Brooklyn, the big left-hander, Chris Van Kuyk. What was that?
I'm not familiar with the name.
I don't know what it all came over. Chris was a big guy, about 6'5".
Chris Van Kuyk.
About 6 foot six and weighed about 240, 250 pounds. And we got them down, and Chris started to throw them at our ball players. And I charged the mound, and here he is, clear up here. And we had a big fight over that, big to-do over the whole thing. And after that fight, Chris Van Kuyk couldn't even get the ball over the plate after that. So it seemed like the fight took everything out of him and took everything out of that Montreal ball club.
Were you a feisty player?
Oh, yeah. I didn't like to lose. I was feisty toward my own ball players if I thought they weren't hustling and not doing some of the things they should. I'd get feisty with them, and I just never liked to lose a ball game.
Were you a mean pitcher?
Yes. Yeah.
Were you a headhunter?
I was a headhunter, and my first experience at that was with Jackie Robinson at the plate. I went into a ball game in Brooklyn. It had to be in Boston. And I was the third ball pitcher in the ball game in the second inning, and Brooklyn was already beating us 9-0. I think Vern Bickford started the ball game, and he didn't think he got one out, and they got about 6 runs. So Max Sircomp come in, and I think it was in the second inning. They already had us down 9-0, and I went in with bases loaded, and I think struck Hodges out for the last out. Started the third inning. I think it was Pee Wee Reese got a base hit and was on base, and Jackie Robinson come up, and Cooper started giving me the knockdown sign because he had already had 2 home runs in that first 1 or 2 innings. So I started to see the knockdown pitch, and I'm shaking my head at Walker Cooper, and he calls timeout, and he runs out there and he hollers, "God damn it, when I tell you to knock somebody down, you knock them down." And I said, "Well, Walker, I want to get ahead of these ball players. I want to make a showing and try to get ahead of them. I don't want to get behind them." So I threw this knockdown pitch close to Robinson, and next pitch, you see, knocked down again. And shake my head, and Cooper did the same thing, come running out, get some guts. I knock him down again, and I got 2 balls and no strikes on him. Third time here, that big fist again, knocked down. And I'm shaking Cooper off, and I'm shaking him off, and he's yelling, "Get some guts," cussing at me, and I threw one that sat Robinson down real good. Well, the next thing I saw was Robinson running out of him, and Cooper right behind him, and Cooper got him by the back of the shirt and the seat of the pants, and practically picked him up and back. Well, then pretty quick I got blindsided by one of their ball players. I think it was Rocky Bridges. Blindsided me and put me from back behind. Well, about as soon as he did that, Ed Matthews come running in and tagged him on. And then Earl Torgerson come running over, and Earl Torgerson was mean. He didn't want to fight anybody. And by then, Leo Drosher slipped by somebody and took a swing at me. Earl Torgerson hit Drosher and knocked him down. And Robinson and I threw a couple of punches at each other, but we didn't hit each other. But, he was just close enough. I didn't wait on the mound for him. I went up to meet him, and this is when Cooper got in, and Robinson swinging, and so was I, and we missed each other.
What happened to you in that game?
I went pitched until about the seventh inning, and I think I gave up one more hit through the four innings that I pitched. And then I think in the meantime we came up to about 9-5, 9-6, and then he brought in another pitcher, brought in Dave Jolly or one of those guys to follow up to see if we could to put in a pinch hitter for me and try to get some more runs. And I think we lost the ball game 10-6, 10-7. It was close.
Did Robinson, did you ever face Robinson after that?
I
was he able to hit you?
I think Robinson in that ball game that I think I only pitched against him that one more time. And I think Robinson possibly got a single in that ball game. And I think the one who did the most hitting in that ball game that I beat him 8-3 was Carl Ferrello. I had a hard time with Carl Ferrello getting in.
A lot of people did, so you were in good company, I'm sure. Were you involved in any other controversies?
Oh, a little bit with Ralph Kiner. I put him out of the lineup for about 3 or 4 weeks, I think it was. I backed him off and the pitch hit him in the ribs and broke his ribs. And I got some heat from Ralph on that. And when I did hit him, you rookies, oh, there too. I said, well, I told him later on the street, I told him, well, you hit two home runs off me, I'm backing you up. And I said, you were just slow getting out of the way of that pitch.
And what did he say to that?
And he said, you got a little wild on it. And I said, no, it was close to the plate, but you just moved slow. And he did. He was a slow mover. You pitch up on his shoulder, up under his chin, he was very slow moving.
Uh-huh.
Where other guys like Jackie Robinson and some of those guys, you throw close to their heads, they move quick.
If you remember just a few years ago when Andre Dawson broke his jaw or his cheekbone or whatever that was, the film of that, you know, shows his head hanging out over the plate and he froze.
It was practically a strike.
And he hardly moved. You know, he was dead just standing there.
A lot of guys were that way. Now, Solly Hemus used to get up to the plate and stand with his toes 2 or 3 or 4 inches from the plate and then lean out and stick his right arm out over the plate. And if the plate pitch come in close enough, he'd take it on the arm and drop down first base.
Uh-huh.
I think he did that twice I made one ball game, and I told him, hey, if you're going to do that, I'm going to hit you good. And I got him right between the shoulder blades, and I had the St. Louis Ball Club ready to charge. So I thought, what the heck, if he's going to take a pitch that's a strike and get first base for getting hit by a strike. And in those days, if they leaned out over the plate and the pitch would hit them, I don't know if it's still the same way or not today. If they're leaning out over that plate and hits them and it's a strike, I think they still get the...
I believe if you get hit, you know, then you get first base. It definitely sounds like you had a great career as a head.
To me, they ought to give the hitter interference on pitches that are strikes, just like they give pitcher interference on touching the bat.
Oh, I agree. I think. What is your opinion of this? The plate belongs to the pitcher.
I think it does. The plate belongs to that pitcher and that catcher. And that batter's box belongs to the hitter. He's got that batter's box, but you see so many of these guys, even they back up the catchers back 2 or 3 foot by having their back foot clear back out of the end of the batter's box. You'll see a lot of them go up there. The first inning, that chalk mark on the back of the batter's box is gone.
Somebody I heard, Gibson or Drysdale or one of those, said that he always took the attitude that the outside half of the plate was his and the inside half belonged to the hitter. And he wanted to be in a position where he controlled that outside half and you couldn't get your bat on it. If he got a ball on the outside half of the plate, you were not going to hit the ball. And the way you do that then is back the hitter farther and farther away from the plate.
There were some of those guys wouldn't back up. Even after I hit Solly Hemus between the shoulder blades, he didn't back off. The next time up the plate, he's got that right foot right up next to the plate practically and that arm out over.
Who was the toughest ball player you pitched? Or played with, as far as that goes?
Oh, I'd say tough as a ball player or tough as a...
The grittiest, the one who would do anything in order to win. The one who would play the hardest.
Enos Slaughter.
Yeah.
Enos Slaughter was just a plain go-getter and... if he didn't like you on the ball field, he'd let you know it. He'd stand out there now, like with me, and like some of the other pitchers on the Braves, he'd stand up there at the plate and walk up. Tell him, you can't get me out, kid. Holler at you. Stand there and just stare at you with a nasty look on his face, and pretty quick you're looking around, here he is on first or second base, and he was tough.
Uh-huh.
He was a ball player, a lot like Rose, but I think he was even tougher going into the bases than Rose was. I don't think he would go in to knock somebody down to hurt him. His spikes, he slid in feet first, and his spikes were always up in your face.
Right.
If he slid into home plate, he wouldn't go in there like a football player to maybe hurt somebody. His spikes were up there, and you had to look through his spikes to catch the ball.
Uh-huh.
Or to tag him one way or another.
You got to play with a couple of Hall of Famers. Well, what can you tell me about Eddie Matthews?
Eddie was a great ball player. Real strong. Very strong. He hit some of the longest baseballs I saw hit beside Mickey Mantle's balls. But Ed Matthews was, I think he, myself, I think he was a better outfielder than he was third baseman. Because I think Ed was too big to really move around like he, like a smaller guy on third base. But Ed was a great outfielder, and I think he was a better hitter when he was playing the outfield.
From what I've read about Matthews, he was very bitter about how long it took him to make the Hall of Fame. As an example, seems to think that as a coach, I guess he was with the Braves in Atlanta, that he ended up being shafted somehow or other there. Did Matthew seem to have a chip on his shoulder?
I think he had, was unhappy with the Braves management, and I think he possibly had a chip on his shoulder. My last year with them, it seemed like it could have been that way, but yet I roomed with him too, and over a period of time, and Ed was a nice guy to room with.
Mm-hmm.
Nice guy to room with, and even after that season was over, I had my car back there, and Ed drove back with me from Boston, came through here, and caught the plane out at Stapleton to go on home to California.
I believe Matthews has had some problems with the bottle.
I think after... Now, when I was playing with him, he didn't have to start drinking yet.
Uh-huh.
But this is what I heard, that too, that after that World Series in, what was it, 53 or 54?
57 or 8. With the
Braves. Let's see. Didn't they go into the series right away, about the second year after they moved to Milwaukee?
They became a contender the first year, but didn't actually win it until 57.
Well, I think it was that 53-54 season that I understood after that he really got onto the bottle. And I think he went through a divorce with his wife, and she was a real beauty queen. She was beautiful. I think that I don't know. I stayed in contact with only one ball player really after things were over, and it was Chuck Tanner. And Chuck never did like drinking. Chuck was never a drinker. And I don't know whether he ever got started drinking or not, but he was never a drinker that I knew of. He was the one that told me that Ed Matthews got drinking real bad. Of course, there were guys on that Braves ball club that were heavy drinkers, that Warren Spahn, Burdett, Vern Bickford. And that's what I understood Vern Victor did, was died from alcoholic poisoning, a heart attack on top of it. But, you know, you never, when you hear this from other ball players, you don't know whether it's true or not. You just take it with a grain of salt and figure, well, that's their business.
Warren Spahn, a drinker, a Hall of Famer, a late blooming pitcher. Tell me about Warren Spahn.
I don't know how Warren Spahn won like he did when he was a drinker like that. The night before he pitched, he never drank, but he worried before a ball game start he would be in the John, going all the time and heave up, and But once he threw that first pitch, that was all gone.
Uh-huh.
He was a real worrier before a ball game, but like I say, but after he threw that first pitch, then all of then he's smiling, everything was great. One of the finest left-handed pitchers that I think a person could ever watch. He was very graceful. He was had one of the best moves to first base. He'd pick guys up at first base that were standing there jawing with the umpire, with the first baseman, and maybe 2 foot off the base, and he'd pick them off.
Uh-huh.
And he had a good screwball, and he'd get the right-handers out on the screwball that he had killed. And on top of that, he was a good hitter. I think that one year he hit 4 or 5 home runs during the season. A real good hitter.
A lot of the best pitchers are good hitters. I know in the National League today, if you run down the best pitchers, most of them will be competent with the bat.
Good hitters.
Frank Viola isn't, but most of them. Were there any teammates that you didn't get along with?
I got along with most of them. One catcher the Braves had, Abba St. Clair, I never got along with him. He and I battled, I think it was over more or less him. When I first went with the Braves, I started to rooming with him before I got with Cooper. And there was always women in the room, and I couldn't get in the room at night. I was about rested one night for sitting up in the hall waiting for women to get out of the room. And I told him I wasn't going to put up with that. Something come up about it. Well, his wife better not ever find out about that. I told him that. Then you're going to have to go to the management and tell them different roommates or something, because I'm not going to sit out in the hall every night. He and I didn't get along. I just, I think it was mostly from that. He and I just did not get along.
were there any teammates that you were particularly close to? You mentioned Cooper.
Walker Cooper and... Earl Torgerson. Earl Torgerson and Vern Bickford and I used to go out and play golf just about every day. And Bob Burris, when he was with the catching with the Braves too, now he was with them there, and they were shifting Burris and Eva St. Clair back and forth to the minor leagues one way or another. And I got along with Burris all the time. Paul Burris, not Bob Burris, Paul Burris.
Okay. Were there any real characters, any flakes that you played with or against that made an impression on you?
No, John Logan was flaky.
Yeah, in what ways?
Oh, he... Brooklyn boy, just his different brogues of things that he did, and he was a small guy, but yet he would fight. He was a battler, he would fight anybody. But he was just sort of, you know, growing up on the streets of Brooklyn, he was just sort of different. How those people are that grow up on the street like that.
Yeah.
Do kooky things, and they're just sort of kooky.
Are there any examples that you can recall?
What the heck was one of the main things that started things out with him? Somebody come up. I think he was writing a letter in the hotel. A little correspondence, John. Oh, I'm just using little paper and pencil to write to the parents. He didn't know what correspondence meant. He asked somebody later, what are they talking about, correspondence? Just different things like that, and guys would kid him all the time about his Brooklyn brogue, and he just sort of dressed most of the time. A lot of times he'd look like somebody just come out of the Ivy League school, but other times he looked like the Brooklyn kid he was. I don't know, the only other real kooky guy that is Max Sertnoff used to carry cherry bombs around with him all the time.
I'm sure that was a lot of fun.
Let him go in the hotels, and we went through into the Philadelphia airport, and they had these great big marble urns in there. They'd stand probably 5 foot high with sand in it. People would put out their cigarettes or whatever. Max put a cherry bomb in the back of a cigarette and set it up in there. And we all got out on the bus and outside of there, and we were sitting on the bus about 5 minutes, and we heard a doggone thing like a bomb went off. That thing being in that marble urn, all of a sudden here comes all kinds of cops in and out, and just flying around, and we're sitting on the bus, just all of us knew what went on. Even Charlie Grimm was a little upset, but he sat there and laughed. Charlie liked to have good time.
Tell me about Charlie Grimm.
He was great, great, great man. He was like Bob Coleman. He would sit down and eat with you, he'd sit down and drink a beer with you, but yet he didn't really socialize with you. But yet it wasn't beyond him to go out and eat with the guys every once in a while, or go with one certain guy here, maybe one certain guy here, but he never made a friend of any of them, you know, a close tie with any of them. Charlie was a jokester, being on the third baseline. He would drop on his back if he didn't like the call. He'd drop right flat on his back, and stuff like that. And I guess Charlie was quite a drinker, but some of us younger guys never ever saw it. The older ones may have seen it, but us younger guys didn't see his drinking. I guess he was a pretty good drinker. But I learned the polka dance from him, because he was an old German, and Milwaukee was full of German people, Polish people. And
had he been the manager in Milwaukee?
Yes, he came up from Milwaukee, and then he got to be the manager of after they fired Tommy Holmes.
Well, were you in Boston with the Braves under Holmes at all? Or?
Yes. Oh. And Tommy Holmes was a different kind of a manager. He didn't know us younger guys. He only knew the older guys. He was, and his wife was everywhere where we were. His wife was there, and after the ball games, he and his wife were out by themselves eating whatever they did. I think now with guys like Spahn and Sane and those guys, they probably go eat and things with them. But the younger guys, Tommy Holmes didn't even know we were around. The first year I went to spring training with him, Billy Southworth was the manager.
Right.
And Billy Southworth did not know us young guys were around. He was anti-youth movement. I never talked much to Billy Southworth. I never talked much to Tommy Holmes. I figured, well, if they can't come around and talk to me, it's not my place to go up to them. I was just never a brown noser. I guess that's what hurt me a lot too, because I was never a brown noser.
Charlie Grimm was accessible.
Yeah, you could, if you had a gripe or this or that, you could go in and talk to Charlie. It just like when I got sent down from spring training, I was the only pitcher on the ball club that had any options left to be sent back. Mm-hmm. Well, Bob Buell come out of the service, and he says, I've got to go along with Bob Buell because he throws about 9,800 miles an hour. And what the heck was the... John Quinn was the operations manager, general manager, and he said, no matter whether Bob Buell's been in the service for 2 years after his record of in Dallas, and I think Dallas was the double A then, before he went in the service, they said, we've got to have Bob Buell on the ball club because he can throw hard. And so that left me with the only options to go back, and I got sent to Toledo, and I had a good spring training that year, a real good spring training. And I went in and talked to Charlie, and I told him, can you try to get me traded? Now, I had heard that Leo Grosser had wanted my contract, but the Braves said, if you want his contract, $30,000 for it. Well, here they are paying me, $6,500 a year or something like that, and then to get rid of me, they want $30,000 for my contract. And a guy like Grosser is not going to pay $30,000 for my contract when I'm only making $6,500. Sure. $7,500, something there like that.
So you were stuck.
So I was stuck, and I kept asking Charlie Grimm all the time. I said, see what you can do to get me traded. And Charlie said, I'll do everything I can, but he said, I'll tell you the truth, they're not going to let you go. And that sort of made me better right there toward the Braves, because then I'd come up with a sore arm and in the meantime, throwing batting practice and everything else while it was cold weather.